accept the reality of the world with which we're presented. It's as simple as that.
Billions of people just living out their lives. Oblivious.
They taught you good. Made you believe their world.
You can deny all the things I've seen, all the things I've discovered, but not for much longer. Because too many others know what's happening out there. And no one, no government agency has jurisdiction over the truth.
Hello and welcome to Beyond the Paradigm. I'm your host, Paul Brackell. Welcome back to all my regular listeners. And if you are a new listener, you are very welcome here. We cover many different topics. We've looked at UFOs, we've looked at giants, we've looked at the global conspiracy as a whole, we've talked about the roadmap to war, we've looked at into the truth behind how the World War I started, how World War II started, we've covered a variety of topics. And this is one of the things I've just been thinking about is what other topics could I cover and what other guests could I have on the show? And if any of you have any ideas of topics you would like covering or actual guests, you could email me. And you can email me at beyondtheparadigm@yahoo.com. I have received emails in the past and I've also had an email regarding a particular guest that I'm going to look into. And it would be helpful and it would be appreciated. And I will take any recommendations on board and I will certainly look into them. Another way you can help me out is following the show if you are a regular listener, and then leaving me a review. I've seen there has been a few reviews left just recently over the last week, so I thank people who have done that. It helps the show become more visible because of the algorithms. The more reviews, the more your episodes appear further up in the list when people are looking on the different podcasting platforms for things to look for. So it's extremely helpful and boosts the show visibility, which would be a great thing for this show. Every week there seems to be another one or two countries of where people are tuning in from, and I never expected this, so I'm thankful to God for that. Another way that you can help the show out, if you're so inclined, is to sign up to my Patreon. You will get access to the Discord server. You will get voting rights on what topics you want on the show. You will get a shout out on air and you'll just simply help the show as well stay on air. There are costs incurred every single month to keep this show going. I do enjoy it, but like I said, there is costs incurred. And if you feel so inclined, you can go to patreon.com/beyondtheparadigm. But if you don't want to pay a regular monthly amount, that's fine, no problem. You could make a single donation at buymeacoffee.com/beyondthep5. And as usual, I'm going to leave all the links in the show description. You can also get hold of me on Twitter at twitter.com/paradigm_79 or on Instagram, paradigm1979. I'm more active on Twitter, but you can connect with me through them. So today I have another guest with me, as usual. My guest today is a gentleman by the name of Ole Damgaard. Ole is a truth seeker, a code breaker and a peacemaker, and he's been awarded the Prague Peace Prize and he was even adopted by the Apache Nation. He's an author, an international speaker, a former journalist, a musician. He's a composer, a coach, an artist, an inventor and an investigator, and he's dedicated more than 40 years of his life to researching many of the global conspiracies. Ole has given more than 1,100 international interviews and millions of viewers and listeners around the world have taken part in his impressive findings and presentations. His main focus has been to find out the truth about main top political assassinations such as JFK, the Swedish Prime Minister, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, John Lennon and other high profile targets. He's also looked into the truth around these mass shootings and so-called terrorist attacks and the fires in Maui, the Bataclan massacre, the Boston Marathon bombing, 9/11 and many more. And today I'm going to be talking to Ole about Operation 40 and celebrity assassinations. And you might be thinking to yourself, well, what is Operation 40? Well, if you sit back now, I'm going to go and bring Ole onto the show and you will find out what Operation 40 is. Ole Damgaard, thank you for joining me. Welcome to Beyond the Paradigm.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Paul.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Thanks for doing this. So I'm familiar with your work, and I know that you've been doing this for over 40 years and you've done multiple podcasts. I think I read somewhere you've done well over 1,000 interviews. But just for those of my audience who possibly are not familiar with your work, could you just give us a brief background into what sort of led you into doing this research that you do now?
It's not easy to just answer briefly because I was born in Denmark, grew up in Sweden, and then I one of the first jobs I had was as a journalist, and that was the thing that got me sort of interested in what is going on because I got very confused early on. And then in 1980, the first time I saw the so-called Zapruder movie or film of the assassination of JFK, where you can clearly see that the final headshot that hits Kennedy in the head throws his head back and to the left. And the official narrative says that the shooter was behind him, but 6 floors up and to the right, or behind him to the right, meaning that had he been hit from that direction, his head would have been thrown forward and to the left, not backwards. So in 1980, I know the exact minute when it happened. When I saw that, I mean, right away, I mean, I'm a simple individual. It just Farmer Brown logic, which I call it, like if something hits you and your head is thrown backwards, it must have come from that direction, boom, like that. So at least one shooter was behind a picket fence. But the official narrative that was backed by all the big forces, the big powers in media and documentaries and politicians and you name it, all of them said the same thing. It's up there. And I was like, it was so not. There's something completely wrong here. And that was the thing that got me started. And now, 43 years later, I've been di in direct contact with the person who fired that shot. I've interviewed him 3 times recently. The guy who fired the shot from behind the picket fence, who was just one or multiple shooters in DV Plaza that day. So, but also I found out over the years, like you said, I've done more than 1,200 interviews. I've been touring in 16 countries. I've been as a one-man band. I've really done my utmost to really expose the truth, because the truth is the only thing that matters, in my opinion. And so, but I also recently, like 4 years ago, found out that my parents were living a double life where I was, without knowing it, my whole life, I had no idea, but they were working as secret assets for NATO, creating the Gladio Ghost Army, which in the early days after the Second World War was for a good purpose, you know, for defense against the invasion from the East. But then it was hijacked by the CIA, who started using it for their strategy of tension with random acts of violence. It was the CIA that was creating that whole thing. And the whole Gladio Ghost Army, which is super, super important to understand if you want to understand what's going on in the world now, was hijacked and into something really, really ugly. And my parents managed to, that's the reason why I moved overnight as a child from Denmark to Sweden without even having time to say bye-bye to my friends or anything. Never understood that my parents died years ago, never mentioned a word. And now I'm understanding, and I've really gone very deep into my background, and I found that more or less everything that happened in my life was connected to NATO. The people, the friends my parents had, where we lived, the neighbors we had, why we went to holidays there, and why the whole it's was connected to NATO. And I even believe that my parents was put together as assets, not from a couple falling in love, but that they were put together as a couple of agents, and were part of the cover for these operations that was needed in those days, were a perfect family and were kids who needed as the front. And I believe that I could very possibly have been born into this world as part of a NATO operation. It's bizarre to say it, but I really, the more I look into it, the more it feels like that. So very bizarre.
Wow. Wow. I did read something before on your website. It's in a little, because I was just quickly looking through it. It said that I think you mentioned about your dad being involved in that. I mean, and you've mentioned Gladiator, and obviously that's Operation Gladiator, which is something I want to cover in a future episode. But today, what I wanted to talk to you about was Operation 40. And obviously, the group was officially non-existent for decades. And apparently, in 2014, the CIA sort of admitted that this Operation 40 existed. But could you go into detail about what Operation 40 actually is?
Yeah, is and was. I would say that I would strongly suggest that it's still active, but it has been regrouped, reformed, reshaped over the years. But Operation 40 was a group. Let me rewind the tape. In the late 50s, we had the OSS with Eisenhower as a president. We had Nixon as vice president, and the CIA, which was the OSS up until 46 or 47, had started to work when they regrouped into the CIA with Alan Dulles in as it said, they started carrying out a very dark agenda that included coup d'etats, assassinations, you name it, all over the world. And the agency became like an agency for hire for big companies, multinational companies, and so on that wanted to get rid of opposition or nationalists or like presidents that were elected by the people, thinking about the people, and who wasn't gonna bend over just because these big companies wanted to invade their countries. So the CIA became like this agency that could be rented or hired for carrying out acts that would make business easier, for these big companies, big casinos, the mafia, and so on. So they started carrying out a long line of successful coup d'etats and also assassinations. But what they found was they were using old Roman templates of how to get away with these assassinations and so on, blaming it on some innocent patsy. But where it actually was exactly like the old Romans were doing it, the exact way that the modus operandi. But the issue was that every time there was a new country, they had to train a new group, they had to train, find a new patsy, they had to train all of these things over and over and over again. So in the late 50s, somebody, I'm not really sure who came up with the idea, was to make a mobile unit that could be used anywhere in the world for assassinations, meaning that you got some highly skilled killers, you got some very skilled people in blackmail, extortion, counterfeiting, whatever was needed, in different operations that could be moved around so that you didn't have to redo it again. It was easier and easier to transport people with airplanes, sometimes even big military planes and so on. So Dwight Eisenhower was officially one of the first people who came with the idea. But Eisenhower was a former bodyguard of George Bush, Prescott Bush, who was the father of George Bush Sr. And he was sort of the guy that was put into the position as president by Bush Sr.'s father, Prescott Bush. Anyway, so Dwight Eisenhower came up with the idea of Operation 40. It was not him, but in the background, you had other people pushing it. And so this idea was approved, completely top secret. I mean, top secret. And then Richard Nixon, as vice president, was given the task to create this mobile team of assassins. So he gave the task to three old CIA wolves. Ted Shackley, E. Howard Hunt, and David Atlee Phillips. These are very, very important names to remember because you will see they just get there all over the place from the early 60s and onwards, all again and again and again and again around the world when it comes to drugs and and like extermination programs and assassinations and coup d'etats, just over and over, the same little group of people. Anyway, so these three people were given a task to create this force, like Murder Incorporated Mobile. And what they did was, at that time in the early 60s, the big monster on stage was Fidel Castro. He was the guy that was the one that they wanted to get rid of, at least officially. It's later turned out that Castro was also a CIA asset. But anyway, so these three CIA operatives went down to Florida, where they were working from a station called JM Wade, where they started recruiting mostly exiled Cubans. The exiled Cubans were recruited from the Cuban Air Force, military, police, and so on. Many of them very brutal, and they hated Castro for what he had done. And so it was very easy to recruit these people. But they also had Americans involved. We had people like Jimmy Files, he's the guy who actually fired the shot from behind the picket fence in Dealey Plaza. But also people like Dave Ferry. We had Lee Harvey Oswald was involved indirectly, also sort of on the outskirts. But anyway, these people were recruited, and then they were trained at Lake Pontchartrain, north of Louisiana, north of New Orleans in Louisiana, at the Everglades in Florida, and also down in Guatemala, where they were trained in everything connected to death: bombs, explosives, poison, guns, mines, you name it, you name it. But also, because they were trained in jungle warfare, they could get in and out of any place, you know. So that's where this group was created. And to start with, it was called Group 40 or Operation 40. It's the same group. But it's in this small little group you will find key players that keeps returning over and over and over and over again. I just want to correct, Lee Harvey Oswald was never part of Operation 40, but he was part of the people surrounding this group that were where they were being trained and supplied with weapons and all of these things. So that is Operation 40 equals Murder Incorporated Mobile unit that could be transported and carrying out whatever.
So obviously there's been a lot of famous people assassinated, you know, like Martin Luther King, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, Yitzhak Rabin, and obviously we've mentioned JFK, and that's like obviously probably the most famous one. But I wanted to talk to you actually about his brother, Robert Kennedy, because obviously the official story is that he was killed by Saran Saran. But as I know, and you obviously know, the official story isn't true. So, from your research, in your opinion, what's the truth of that assassination of Robert Kennedy? What do you think actually happened, and who killed him, in your opinion?
It is partly Operation 40 in that assassination. It was the same force behind JFK, MLK, RFK, exactly the same players. Also, Che Guevara and many, many other assassinations around the world. So, Robert Kennedy was killed at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, and it was 1968. He had been sort of the attorney general under his brother JFK when he was assassinated. In that assassination, you had three upcoming presidents involved in the assassination of JFK. You had Johnson, Lyon Johnson, Lyon Lyndon Johnson, who was he was just about to go to court and go down for he was accused for being involved in at least eight assassinations, including murders. Through his hitman or henchman, Mac Wallace. Mac Wallace. One of the murders was his own sister, charming Ellen Lyndon Johnson. Then you had Richard Nixon was also involved in this assassination. As you know, he was part of creating Operation 40. He was in Dallas that day as well. George Bush Sr. was also in Dallas. He was the paymaster for Operation 40 during during the early years. And then he was the guy that took Operation 40 with him very closely He was surrounded very closely by these people through his whole career, all the way up, where they were carrying out all kinds of horrible stuff. They all even ended up, on positions like very, very high up in the CIA, and so on. So Robert Kennedy, the problem with Robert Kennedy was that they thought, the dark forces behind this thing thought that if they could get rid of Kennedy, JFK, then they would get rid of Robert Kennedy as well, because Robert Kennedy was put to lead like a witch hunt on the mafia. So Kennedy, JFK, at one point he completely changed after the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was almost like he had an enlightenment. Like he was just like, oh my God, how close are we to destroy this beautiful world? And at that point he said, I'm going to crush the CIA into 1,000 pieces. I'm going to withdraw from the Vietnam War. I'm going to take back the power of the money and make it back to on silver, get out of the Federal Reserve. I'm going to mess it up for Israel. I mean, there's so many different areas where he was just completely breaking the rules, and he made a lot of enemies. And at that time also he put his brother Robert in charge of chasing the mob that had actually helped him into the White House through through illegal vote counting in Chicago through his dad. So the Chicago mob got furious, furious. So many people hated him. But anyway, so when they took out JFK, they thought that they were going to get rid of Robert Kennedy as well. So you kill the dog and the tail dies as well, as the mafia was talking about. And for about 5 years, they were correct, because he was completely knocked out and in such deep sorrow and shock. And I mean, also being so close to the people that did it. I mean, he knew that Johnson was involved. He knew these people, J. Edgar Hoover was involved, and he was surrounded by them. So, I mean, can you imagine? Horrible, horrible, completely ruthless people. So Robert Kennedy just laid down for a few years. At the same time, we had Malcolm X that started really moving forward. They took him out. J. Edgar Hoover and his boys took Malcolm X out. Boom, that was him. But Martin Luther King was a guy that kept moving, and even got the Nobel Peace Prize, which was something unheard of, but he was given it. And had, I mean, people like Johnson, President Johnson, who hated him, J. Edgar Hoover, who hated him, they were looking for all ways, any way to get to him and take him out. They tried to destroy his reputation, they tried to bomb him, they tried to do everything, and he just wouldn't quit. And so Robert Kennedy came in very late in 68 and went into the presidential race with the idea, I believe, that his father would become, no, sorry, now I was thinking about Robert Kennedy Jr., who I've been cl very closely, almost in touch with for about a year or so. But anyway, so the idea, according to people close to Robert Kennedy, was that he was aiming to become the next president and vice president, Martin Luther King. That was the idea. And that duo, oh my, the difference in the world that these two people would have done compared to the ones that took over. So in April of 68, Martin Luther King was killed with some of the same people. That was part from Operation 40, but also, like, it's a really complex assassination. But they took him out, hoping that that would scare off Robert Kennedy, but he just kept going. He just kept going. So about in 2 months later, on the 6th of June, they hit him as well in the Ambassador Hotel. And you have, it's a much smaller assassination when it comes to the people involved on site, but you had multiple shooters there as well. You had people that was in Dealey Plaza that was there that this night as well. And then you had the Patsy. This one is one of the few where you have real MK Ultra people going down. I mean, people that had been tormented through MK Ultra to become assassins. You had this guy, and then Chapman, who is said to have killed John Lennon, but actually the one who killed John Lennon was Jose Perdomo, who was another member and a high-ranking officer of Operation 40. So, but there was multiple shooters in the Ambassador Hotel this evening. We're still confused. There's still a lot of questions around that thing because everything from the very first second was covered up. All the evidence was destroyed. Films was destroyed. All the bullet holes were taken down. But it seems like there were somewhere around 13 shots being fired inside that kitchen. That we've been able to, with sound acoustics and recordings and the number of bullet holes and so on. But in the revolver that Sirhan Sirhan was carrying and also fired, there was only eight. So, I mean, that on its own should just completely blow this case open. But instead, this poor guy, Sirhan Sirhan, has been rotting away and is still in jail to this very day. It's unbelievable. And the people that put him there are so aware of that he's innocent, you know, and they're just not giving him a chance. And he's not the only one. There's many, many people that have been sentenced innocently, you know, that have been patsies for so many different things, whereas actually a very high-level military operation carried out by professionals blamed on a poor, innocent, lone, crazy guy. And the reason they always want them alone is because then by it makes it so much easier to deal with the case because by law, if he's alone, then there's no conspiracy. Conspiracy is two or more people involved in criminal activity. If he's alone and suicided on location, which he very often is, then so it goes so fast that you can bury the whole case. Thank you and goodbye. Go back to sleep, population, and get out. And the reason why they want him crazy is because then you can say, well, he was just mentally ill. There was no motive, there was no reason, nothing to look into. Thank you and goodbye again. So every time you hear about lone crazy guys or lone wolves, or I mean, make that sort of like a warning sign where beep, beep, beep goes off.
Yeah, I watched an interview with Sirhan Sirhan last night. Like it was like his parole hearing, and he doesn't remember it. And obviously, you know, we know that MK Ultra's, well, it's an official program. I spoke to Kathy O'Brien the other week, who was in MK Ultra, and obviously they mind control people. But I listened to RFK Jr. regarding the assassination of his dad, and he had some interesting things to say. I mean, obviously you mentioned that Sirhan Sirhan only fired eight shots, and apparently the first two shots, one hit a bodyguard that was near RFK, hit him in the head, and another one hit the wall. Then people in the room grabbed Sirhan Sirhan and pinned him down with his arm behind his head, which another six shots went off, and other people were injured. So all those shots were accounted for. But what he said was is that there was another shooter in the room who was actually a guy called Thane Eugene Caesar, who had been sort of hired in the probably about a week before. And he was the one who sort of shepherded RFK towards Sirhan Sirhan. But he drew his gun. This is what he was saying. And actually, the autopsy, when they examined RFK, there was four shots which were called contact shots, which RFK Jr. was saying that it's almost like whoever shot him was so close to him, and the gun was held like in an upward fashion, like it was being pressed behind him. And what you can see from when RFK is on the floor is there's a tie on the floor. And this Thane Eugene Caesar, he was wearing a tie, but it was his tie that was on the floor. And what RFK Jr. was saying is that his father had reached behind and pulled his tie off. And that's initially what he had in his hand before they took it out of his hand and they put some rosary beads in his hand. And that, I mean, that's, well, like you said, the fact that there was, you said 13 shots, and only eight of them came from Sirhan Sirhan. To me, it seems pretty obvious he's not the shooter. I mean, even RFK Jr. doesn't believe Saran Saran shot his father.
But you know, it's like, I must say, Robert Kennedy Jr. really did it take you like 50 years to come to a conclusion that so many of the rest of us, I mean, I know so much more of about these than he does, which I find strange. But yet again, I can understand the Kennedy family have been going through so many different tragedies. I mean, there's been so many members of this clan who died in this very odd ways and very violent ways and suicides and crashes and you name it. So, and maybe he was scared to look into it because, I mean, his uncle JFK was killed, his father killed. And I think maybe this is one of the reasons he had this disease, throat disease, which is very psychosomatic, you know, and I think driven under stress. And so I think this is one of the reasons that he think that he subconsciously know that speaking out could lead to his own death. And I think that there's this struggle inside. But anyway, with the Caesar, I mean, he was a guy that was working for Lockheed Martin, and he was taken into, he was only working that night. And just like you said, he was the guy, he was not the guy that led them into the kitchen because that was not the way they should have gone. And also from a security point of view, not the way to lead him. Instead, there was one of the people in the RFK entourage that was that pointed to that door, and then the same Eugene Caesar came up behind him. He was walking behind and to the right. He was holding the arm of RFK, walking towards through this kitchen where people were approaching. It was packed with people. It's a very small little area, and where Robert Kennedy was just saying hello to one of the kitchen personnel, a guy from the Philippines, I think, when Sirhan approached from the front with the he held the gun down, and RFK was just about to shake his hand or meet him when Sirhan pulled up the gun, but at no point were he any closer than 5 to 6 feet from him, in front of him, meaning that RFK should have been hit from straight from the front. But that is not what we see. Instead, we see there's four shots that hit RFK. As far as I remember, there was only one went through his coat, but then you had three in an upward angle from the right and upwards, which is exactly where Thane Caesar was standing, with a 22 as well. He had a 22 as a service revolver. People saw him fire, and they also saw that RFK was sort of struggling with him, and that's when the tie was pulled off, and was. Yeah, just like you say, he was down on the floor next to him. Then, when Time magazine and other major magazines published that photo, they covered up the tie, so you can't see the tie because that is a direct point. And the pathologist that did the autopsy, he said that the one behind his the right ear, that was the one that killed him. I mean, that was. There were like powder burns, so it's like maximum like 2 or 3 inches from, if not point blank, to the head, and that is exactly where Thane was there standing. But then you have other shots that were fired that doesn't match up with the shots fired from Sirhan's gun. So there was another shooter in the kitchen as well, and it's said to be one of the photographers that there was a photographer with a gun inside the camera, so that the camera was actually firing. But there was also another assassin that were also in Dealey Plaza. His name is Clade Forshaw. That was dressed like another of these kitchen personnel or people. That was an assassin in the very same room. But the photos of him have just disappeared. This is the tricky thing. But I have from his cousin, Clade Forshaw's cousin, have testified about how he's been bragging about this assassination. He lives, if he's still alive, he lives in Toronto, Canada. And he was also one of the shooters in Dealey Plaza, together with his cousin, Walter Tobinski, who are some of these shooters. So we see the recycling of the same people because they were very good at what they were doing. These many of them were trained from childhood and upwards as assassins as part of these assassination programs.
It's just crazy, and it's clear that they must use the same people, like you said, because they're highly trained. It's not like they're using new people all the time, but there's only like certain people that are trained to such this high level. Another one that I wanted to talk to you about, which is one I remember very well, is August 31, 1997. Lady Diana was killed in a fatal car crash. And obviously, the official story regarding that is that, she was in a car that was being chased by paparazzi. And this driver, Henry Paul, he had a few drinks and he crashed in a tunnel. And that's meant to be it, open and close case. But I don't believe that's what's happened. What's your opinion on that, the killing of Diana?
This one is a really tricky one because it is in different layers and I'm confused. So the official story, absolute bullshit on steroids. That's not a true word there at all. I mean, Henri Paul, it said, I mean, when they checked his blood and so on, he had been officially drinking so much that he couldn't even stand up, but he was completely sober at the hotel. And so what seems to have happened is that there were two cars and a bike and a motorbike with two people on it. So they were being sort of chased towards this Alma Tunnel, where all the CCTV cameras, there was 14 that just suddenly didn't work that night. So all of that was closed down. And then you had, if I remember right, you had one Fiat, you had one. There were this black Mercedes and then a Fiat. There was another car involved as well. And then there was this motorbike. And just when the Mercedes came and was going into the entrance, this white Fiat, there's like an entry road coming up right before the tunnel, went out and hit the Mercedes. At the same time, the motorbike had overtaken and the guy that was sitting on the back turned around and had a military laser completely blinding. It's a really powerful weapon. It takes you minutes afterwards to regain your sight. That they gave that flash at the same time as the Fiat was hitting the Mercedes as well. So it started swaying like that and it crashed right into the 13th pillar in the Alma Tunnel. But then you have the whole thing about I think it took 1 hour and 43 minutes, if I remember right, for Diana, who was not seriously wounded. She had an inner bleeding, but she was not deadly injured, to take her from the tunnel and until she arrived to the hospital. They did not drive her to the nearest hospital. They drove her to another hospital where people from French and English intelligence were waiting. And also, witnesses saw that the ambulance stopped like 500 600 meters from the emergency entry, and where they could see like it was rocking, like if somebody was doing something. And there's been a lot of suggestion that people were actually, really hitting and pumping her body so that these inner bleedings would become fatal. I mean, it's really, really ugly. And then you have another level. So what I would say is the official narrative, absolutely not a true word. The whole story, everything is just built up on absolute lies, fake documents, fake autopsy protocol, all of it is not true. Then you have a layer where it was carried out by intelligence agencies, where you had the English and the French involved, and where the royal family was involved as well, where in taking her out. But then there's another layer where it's like really confusing, where this is where I'm confused, because that's where it seems like there was a replacement of the body, because the body that had was presented as Lady Diana was already partly decomposed. You know, the time, it's like that it comes to a level where it's like very, very confusing. So I don't know which layer are the, I just know the official narrative, so not true. Then you have the other narrative that she was murdered, which if she died that day, then that is what happened, where many, many witnesses, many people involved have died mysteriously, as they do many times around these big operations. And then you have another level where a lot of people are claiming that she's still alive and that this was staged. So I, this case, I don't know. I'm confused, so I don't want to say anything.
I had a previous guest on here, a guy, an English guy like myself, and he's wrote a number of books. Now, he lives in England, but he's got friends who live in France. And he said that they rang him and said that there was footage. It was never aired in England because I've never seen it, and I don't remember it ever being on the news, and I don't remember anyone ever talking about it. But they said there was some footage of her walking out the ambulance. They seen it. They seen her come out the ambulance.
And this is what I'm saying for. I'm confused because I know exactly what they're talking about. That is the same with Michael Jackson as well. He was also walking out of the ambulance. So what is going on? What is going on? And sometimes when you got a target on your forehead and you know that you're about to be taken out, the only way which has been done repeatedly in history is to die, to get killed. That's the only way to get off that hit list, you know. And sometimes people have arranged for their own death. So what happened? Let's wait a few years more and let's talk again, because I'm still not sure. I would not be surprised if she suddenly popped up. JFK Jr. as well. There's another very, very odd operation there also.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously a lot of so-called people that have died who Elvis is the one that springs to mind. A lot of people say that Elvis never died, and obviously I've seen the so-called footage of Michael Jackson apparently coming out of the ambulance as well. One
Sorry, I'm
other
still.
assassination that I wanted to talk to you about was well, I say assassination, and I say that because I've listened to an interview you've done previously. Now, it's somebody I used to listen to. His music, Bob Marley, loved his music, and he was obviously died. I mean, I was only a couple of years old when he died. He died in May 1981, and obviously he died of a melanoma, which began in his toe. But I've heard an interview you've done, and it's not just as simple as, because it's claimed that it was a football injury. That's the official narrative. What's your take on that?
Bob Marley was just not a singer. Bob Marley was a danger, because Bob Marley was not black, he was not white, he was in between. And his music reached absolute millions and millions all over the world, including Africa, where Africa, he became extremely popular in Africa, where all of these countries that have been colonized with incredible riches in nature and mines and gold and diamonds and all of the, they started standing up, you know, unite. His songs became this whole thing. He even toured in Africa. He was also one of his partners was I think she was She was the daughter of a president, if I remember right, but he was very high up. And also in Jamaica, he was the uniting force to go against the CIA's operation of destabilizing the country. The CIA was pumping in guns on both sides. There was almost a civil war going on. But Bob Marley was the one that united the two sides and was holding and trying to keep the lid on this bomb that was about to explode. So the CIA sent in a team of assassins first. And one time they were rehearsing in his house. It was his he was in the kitchen together with his wife and his manager. I believe it was his manager. And these four people just kicked in the door and just fired. I don't know how many shots. His wife was hit in the head. His manager was hit 5 times, and Bob Marley had a bullet that just striped his arm but didn't wound him. But even though that happened, he still went up and he did an interview, no, a concert. Against all odds, showing that this is a guy that would not be scared off. So he really stood up and said, I'm going to do this till the day I stop breathing, meaning major problem, because this is a guy they could not scare off or destroy his credibility or person or whatever, a problem. So after this happened, there was a documentary maker that came to Jamaica to make a documentary about Bob Marley. And so Bob Marley was surrounded by his own bodyguards, but this American came and presented the idea, and Bob said, please let him in, let him in. And so this guy came in. He described what he was going to do, but he also said that I brought this gift for you, because Bob Marley loved jeans, he loved football, and he loved cowboy boots. So he brought this gift of a pair of American cowboy boots. So Bob got really thrilled, and I got this from a photographer who was there at the time when it happened. So Bob pulled on when he pulled pulled on one of these boots, he just cried out of pain, pulled off the boot again, and inside it there was a piece of copper that had punctured his big toe. That toe is where he later started, and where the cancer spread from. How many people do you know who had a big toe cancer? That is not sort of the normal thing, but that is what he died from. But it was like when he was playing football that the toe just broke open like that. So that's when they say it was a football injury. No, it was way before. Now, the interesting thing is, who is the documentary maker? And his name was Carl Colby, who is the son of William Colby, who was the director of the CIA. So I ask you, what are the chances? What are the chances that me, I'm not pointing directly towards this guy, because he could have very well be duped, the documentary, by his father and the CIA to bring these pair of boots. But it's not the first time ever that they injected cancer into someone. And a piece of copper wire that punctured the toe, if that was poisoned by something cancer causing, and the CIA are known for their toys, very fast growing cancer. So I think the only reason he lasted for so long was because he was smoking a lot of marijuana, which has an incredible effect on cancer. So, and then while he was sick, he was approached by a German doctor who has a very, very suspicious background that said, come to me. I think it was in Switzerland. Come to Switzerland. We will take good care of you. But according to his mother, he was almost tortured there, and he was starved. And he was like, when he died, he had gone through absolute hell. And this was from a super right-wing doctor that it was almost like Sieg Heil type individual connected with very odd connections. That, if you ask me, I think that was part of the operation to make sure that he died. So very tragic, beautiful individual. And I think he has 11 children. They're pushing forward his music to this very day.
Yeah, I loved it growing up. His music, and it was a uniting force, wasn't it? Like you said, I know his father was a white man, his mother was a black man. So, and he wasn't really accepted in the white community or the black community, which is often the case, unfortunately. But he was a uniting force. So that, I mean, is that your opinion as to why they got rid of him? Because they don't want us united, do they? They like to cause division.
It's like every time you see somebody stand up like that, you had John Lennon. What was the problem with him? He was too popular. When he said stuff, it had an impact, and millions of people listened. What was the problem with Diana? She was too popular. When she said something, it really had an impact. When she started standing up about landmines, which I think is the reason, one of the major reasons that she was killed, was the landmine issue that she was starting to talk out against, where you had millions and millions of, especially housewives, that didn't get involved in these type of things otherwise, but suddenly she was going up against that. And landmines are super, super important in their hidden agenda when it comes to the way of these forces are carrying out so many different operations, clearing areas through the help of landmines. JFK, too popular, boom. JFK Jr., too popular, boom. And then Bob Marley, too popular. And not, you had Martin Luther King, too popular, but he did the exact same thing. He didn't just turn towards the black, he turned toward the minorities, the poor people, the poor white people, the poor anyone, the Hispanic, the Asian. He was, the 1 million man march that he was proposing was for everyone, not just the black ones. So these forces in the background had made, they have such problems with individuals like that. And so they often terminate them. That's the only way they can do it.
It's so sad, and it's the way of controlling us, because they want this racism sort of debate ongoing and try to point out differences with people, when in reality, I mean, I'm a Christian and I know that all men are created equal, and we are souls with bodies. We're not bodies that have a soul. We are a soul that has a body. And just because someone has more melanin in their skin or less melanin doesn't mean they're any different than we are. And obviously, this is one of the tactics, they're getting rid of these people because they're a uniting force. And like you mentioned, Martin Luther King, the 1 million man march, poor white people, poor Hispanics, poor black people, they can't have that. Do you think that's the reason they got rid of Jimi Hendrix? Do you believe he was assassinated as well?
I know he was assassinated, but it was I think that he was becoming a real problem because he was the first black rock star on that level. He was really moving stuff. But I think the reason he was taken was because of his issues with his manager. I think he was taken out by his manager, not by other forces. That manager who had just put a life insurance on him for $2 million just a week or so before. So he was, but the whole cover up is also because these forces really wanted him gone. So it's a combo. Who carried it out was, it's a, he was drowned in red wine. That is how he died. Held down, and they just filled him up with red wine, so he drowned. So another tragic event. There's so many of them.
What's your take on the Michael Jackson scenario? Do you think he's dead, or what do you think? I just don't know.
Michael is a tricky one. The thing is, with many artists, they're worth more dead than alive. When they start reaching, the 45, 50, suddenly it's starting going down. There's their voices, they're losing their voice, they're losing the young audience, their sales are normally going down there. So sometimes people die, are killed, and then you have Whitney Houston, who was murdered. Not a suicide, not that she fell asleep, actually, but she was found face down in the bathtub, face down in the bathtub, just like her daughter 1 year later. And also, the body was left in the room while it's a bizarre thing. It was left there. They were doing all kinds of stuff with this poor woman's body. Even at midnight, right at midnight, if you look at the autopsy report and the report from the site, they were taking pubic hair and stuff and nails from it at midnight. What the hell is that? If it's not some kind of satanic bizarre stuff. And it was at the Beverly Hilton Hotel while the big, not the Grammys, but the award ceremony, what was that called? It was going on more or less below them. So she, oh, it's just a horrible, horrible. But the sales, everything was prepared for her death. And so within an hour after she died, Sony and many and other companies had already, everything was on standby and boom, released. So they did absolute killing, literally, in sales and memorial stuff. And also the remaking of Bodyguard, they had already prepared that. And they had also found a new, what was her name, Jennifer Hudson, the new Whitney Houston, which was even presented to Whitney before she died. This is the new Whitney, just in your face. So when it comes to Michael is a tricky, tricky one because, I don't know about all of this, these accusations about pedophile things. He was not an ordinary guy. He was absolutely not. He was very childlike, it seems like, even though he was, when he died, he was almost 50 or in his 50s. But there again, you had a career that had started really going downwards, and there was no way out. His reputation was destroyed, his name was destroyed. But he was also in great debt. That was why he was planning this tour, just to pay back the debt, because a lot of people around him had just stolen it, and then he dies. So very strange the way he died. Also, the whole thing around the ambulance, also around the autopsy protocols, also at the funeral, there's this guy dressed all in white, where you can see there's a woman standing in sitting in front of him. Michael loved to do have different makeups and masquerades and stuff like that. And you can see she's turned around and he says something to her. She turns around just like, you can see she says, Michael, And then there's another guy. There was this young child that had been very badly burned that became a friend of Michael that he helped, And then this guy was interviewed on what's his name? One of the big talk shows.
Larry King.
That's the one.
You're
He
talking about
interviewed.
Dave, aren't you?
That's the one.
Yeah.
And when you see that interview, it doesn't look like any. If you compare that burned face with the burned face of the child, it's not the same person. And listen to the voice. If that is not Michael, that is like, but that's the way they do it. When David Bowie died, there's another one that, the guy that was interviewed after David Bowie died, oh my, it looks like him in the, it's like, there are all of these mind tricks or games being played out. If you didn't notice, there was a lot of musicians that died. It was 2016, like in 2 months, they were just like bam, 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 bam. They died like flies officially. So many of these deaths are very, very strange. George Michael is another very strange one. Prince, let's not even talk about Prince. Another very, very odd. So the question is, did they die naturally? Absolutely not, I would say. So how did they die, or did they die? And as part of the work I've done over the years, I've gotten to become friends with former assassins and very high level. On a very high level, like Chip Tatum, who was the private assassin, the private hitman for George Bush Sr., and had was part of taking out 40 different individuals. He was also the pilot for all the presidents from Nixon up to George Bush Sr. He was one of the pilots in the Iran-Contras weapons out down to Nicaragua, El Salvador, Honduras, and raw cocaine back into the US. So not a beginner, I tell you that, not an amateur. He said many times he did flights from the States, mostly to Canada, in small discrete planes, you know, like that, where his job was just to fly the plane from point A to point B, transporting an individual. He was never given a name, but he said more than once he looked over his shoulder and thought, "I thought you were dead." You know, you got the FBI Witness Protection Program that specializes in these things. So there's nothing new, nothing new. And also that's how they get you have assassins like Michael Vann Townley, who also, after having carried out so many different assassinations, was put and protected through a witness the FBI's Witness Protection Program and disappeared once again. So I don't know. I know that I don't know. So that's why I'm not going to say, yes, I know. When it comes to Jim Morrison, it's another one. I tell you, that one smells a long way. Jim Morrison from The Doors, who never wrote a lyric when people saw it. He came with finished lyrics to Laurel Canyon, where they met up in Laurel Canyon outside Hollywood, where so many of these rock bands. When this was not an area where music were produced at all, it was in those days in the early and mid 60s. It was in Memphis, or it was in New York, or so, not in LA at all. And then you had all of these musicians, future rock stars, that were just like a magnet, an invisible magnet that pulled these people together. Most of them were parents in the military industrial complex. And MK Ultra and all kinds of bizarre backgrounds around that. And then equipped by companies, CBS and other record companies, that where they were officially given the finger to these, you know, society and the whole structure. And then the very same structure they were doing this to was backing them with record deals and equipment, learning, teaching them how to play and everything. Bizarre, bizarre, and very often the records had studio musicians, like many of the studio musicians that you hear on records, where it's always The Doors, always this. No, it's not. It's like Elvis and his musicians were often used to many of these ones. There's a woman, an incredible bass player, who played on hundreds of these songs where the band itself, they were not good enough. And then you like Jim Morrison. So Jim Morrison came from nowhere, and boom, he became this mythical individual. And then he died in Paris of an overdose. Boom. His father was the admiral of. Let me just see here. The admiral of the ship that was officially attacked in the Gulf of Tonkin. The thing, because of that attack, the US got into the Vietnam War big time, where they really went for it. It was Jim Morrison's father who was there. At the same time as that happened, Jim Morrison appeared on stage on the rock scene and just became this big legend. Then, this very same day as Jim Morrison died, his father retired from the military. So, if you look at it, it's almost like Operation Activate. And deactivate, and very, very odd. And then you have People have found Jim Morrison. I mean, he's overweight and old, and I don't know. I just find it highly suspicious. And very often you will see also no autopsies. The body is just buried right away. You know, people don't even know that this individual died and then cremated. Thank you so much. And oh, we buried him yesterday, so you can't have a look. But there you go. Elvis, where's Elvis' autopsy? There's nothing there. And people who were at the funeral where Elvis was in the casket said that the individual that was there was breathing. But they said it wasn't Elvis. It looked like he had what do you call it, sideburns that just glued on. It's a bizarre world to get into, of these very weird things. Many of them carried out at a time where people were not so observant, when you didn't have the internet, where you couldn't compare photos and videos and all of these things. It was way 40, 30, 40 years before the internet came and people like us could really look into it. Like when I started, I mean, the internet didn't exist at all. I was in all of these countries trying to find stuff the old way. I mean, really hard work, I tell you that. So, yeah, here
It
we
is a
are,
bizarre
Paul.
world, definitely. It's a masquerade for sure. Thanks for your time today, Ollie. It's been fascinating talking to you. All your years of research, fascinating. But just before we go, could you tell people where they can find your work, about your website?
My website is Light on Conspiracies, plural, lightonconspiracies.com or danagard.com. And I've got more than 1,200, I've been interviewed more than 1,200 times around the world. There's also webinars and podcasts in the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. I really try to pull my load into this. But one thing that it has not given me is any kind of stability financially. And so I've had to change countries twice. I put my family through hell. I've been shot. I've been almost hit by cars. I've been, I don't know how many death threats and so on. So I'm not complaining. I'm just saying, and not the easiest way to make a living. And so if anyone would consider thinking that this was worthwhile, please consider the donation buttons on the website. There's my monthly newsletter. I've got what I believe is the world's biggest research vault. Also, my whole life work on an external hard drive, almost 6 terabyte, that I give access to for a price. It's my whole life, so it comes with a price tag. And there you go.
Wow, so a lot of research. Definitely go on Ole's website. Thanks again, Ole. It's been fascinating. Guys, I'm going to be back next week with another guest, hopefully seeking truth again, like Ole's website says he's a truth seeker, and that's what I am on here. This is what this podcast is all about, getting to the truth. So I'm Paul, and this is Beyond the Paradigm.
Am I crazy? We don't use that word in here.